Reading from The Pirates by George MacDonald Fraser. The dedication reads, "In memory of the Most Reverend and Right Honorable Lancelot Blackburn, 1658 to 1743, Archbishop of York and Buccaneer." Book the First, Chapter the First. It began in the old and golden days of England, in a time when all the hedgerows were green and the roads dusty, when hawthorn and wild roses bloomed, when big-bellied landlords brewed rich October ale at a penny a pint for rakish high-booted cavaliers with jingling spurs and long rapiers, when squires ate roast beef and belched and damned the Dutch over their claret while their faithful hounds slumbered on the rushes by the hearth, when summers were long and warm and drowsy, with honeysuckle and hollyhocks by cottage walls, when winter nights were clear and sharp with frost-rimmed moons shining on the silent snow, and Claude Duval and swift Nick Nevison lurked in the bosky thickets, teeth gleaming beneath their masks as they heard the rumble of coaches bearing paunchy, well-lined nabobs and bright-eyed ladies with powdered hair who would gladly tread a measure by the wayside with the gallant Tobyman and bestow a kiss to save their husbands' guineas, an England where good King Charles lounged amiably on his throne and scandalized Mr. Pepys, or was it Mr. Evelyn, by climbing walls to ogle pretty Nell, where gallants roistered and diced away their fathers' fortunes, where beaming yokels in spotless smocks made hay in the sunshine and ate bread and cheese and quaffed foaming tankards fit to do G.K. Chesterton's heart good, where threadbare peddlers with sharp eyes and long noses shared their morning bacon with weary travellers in dew-pearled woods, and discoursed endlessly of Hudibras and the glories of nature, where burly, ear-ringed smugglers brought their stealthy sloops into midnight coves and stowed their hard-run cargoes of Hollands and Brussels and fragrant Virginia in clammy caverns, where the poachers of Lincolnshire lifted hares and pheasants by the bushel and buffeted gamekeepers and jumped o'er everywhere. An England, in short, where justices were stout and gouty, peasants bluff and sturdy and content, but ready to turn out from Monmouth at a moment's notice, merchant fathers close and anxious, daughters sweet and winsome, good wives rosy and capable with bunches of keys and receipts for plum cordials, Puritans smug and sour and sanctimonious, fine ladies beautiful and husky-voiced and slightly wanton, foreigners suave and devious and given to using musky perfume, serving wenches red-haired and roguish-eyed with 40-inch busts, gentlemen adventurers, proud and lithe and austere, and indistinguishable from Basil Rathbone, and younger sons, all eager and clean-limbed and longing for those far horizons beyond which lay fame and fortune and love and high adventure. That was England then, long before interfering social historians and such carls had spoiled it by discovering that its sanitation was primitive and its social services non-existent, that London's atmosphere was so poisonous as to be unbreathable by all but the strongest lungs, that King Charles's courtiers probably didn't change their underwear above once a fortnight, that the cities stank fit to wake the dead, and the countryside was largely either wilderness or rural slum, that religious bigotry, dental decay, political corruption, fleas, cruelty, poverty, disease, injustice, public hangings, malnutrition, and bear-baiting were rife, and there was hardly an economist or environmentalist or town planner or sociologist or anything progressive worth a damn. There wasn't even a London School of Economics, which is remarkable when you consider that Locke and Hobbes were loose about the place. Happily the stout justices and wenches and gallants and peasants and fine ladies, and even elegant Charles himself, who was nobody's fool, never realized how backward and insanitary and generally awful they might look to the cold and all too selective eye of modern research, and if they had, it is doubtful that they would have felt any pang of guilt or shame, happy, conscienceless rabble that they were. Indeed, His Majesty would most likely have raised a politely skeptical eyebrow. The justices scowled resentfully, and the wenches, gallants, and peasants, being vulgar, gone into hoots of derisive mirth. So, out of deference and gratitude to them all, and because history is very much what you want it to be anyway, this story begins in that other, happier England of fancy rooted in truth, where dates and places and the chronology of events and people may shift a little here and there in the mirror of imagination, and yet not be thought false on that account. For it's just a tale, and as Mark Twain pointed out, whether it happened or did not happen, it could have happened. And as all storytellers know, whether they work with spoken words in Crofts, or quills in Abbotsford, or cameras in Hollywood, it should have happened. Thus. It was on a day when, for example, King Charles was pleasantly tired after a 10-mile walk, and was guiltily wondering whether he ought to preside at a meeting of his Royal Society, or take Francis Stuart to a very funny, dirty play, whose jokes she would be too pure-minded to understand, when Barbara Castlemaine was surveying her magnificence in the mirror, regretting, slightly, the havoc wrought by last night's indulgence, and scheming how to foil her gorgeous rival, the Duchess of Portsmouth, when, in far Jamaica, fat and yellow-faced old Henry Morgan was blowing impatiently into the whistle on the handle of his empty tankard for a refill, and wistfully reminiscing with the boys about flashing-eyed Spanish dames and treasure-stuffed churches of Panama and Portobello, when Mr. Evelyn was noting in his diary that the Duke of York's dog always hid in the safest corner of the ship during sea battles, and Mr. Pepys was recording in his diary that on the previous night he had urinated in the fireplace because he couldn't be bothered going out to the usual offices. And anyone checking these entries will find they are years apart, which gives some idea of the kind of story this is. When Kirk's mercenaries were tramping sweatily across the hot sands of the High Barbary, licking parched lips at the thought of sparkling springs, or dusky Arab beauties in the souk of Tangier, or the day when their discharges would come through. When a dear old tinker was dying of the cold, poor and humble and unnoticed by the great world, with the sound of choiring angels in his ears, and no notion that one day he would be remembered as the greatest writer of plain English that ever was. When the sound of the Dutchman's guns was still a fearsome memory along Thameside, and Louis XIV was dreaming grandiose dreams and summoning his barber for his twice-weekly shave. All these things were happening on the day when the story begins, but they don't really matter, and have been set down for period flavor. The real principals in our melodrama were waiting in the wings, entirely unaware of each other or of the parts they were to play. They don't actually come on just yet, but since they are the stars, we should take a preliminary look at them. First, Captain Benjamin Avery of the King's Navy, fresh from distinguished service against the Sally Rovers in his decent lodging at Greenwich, making a careful toilet, brushing his teeth, combing his hair, adjusting his plain but spotless neckcloth, shooting his cuffs just so, and bidding a polite but aloof good morning to the adoring serving-maid as she brings in his breakfast of cereal, 2 boiled eggs, toast and coffee, and scurries out with a breathless, fluttering curtsy. Captain Avery straightens his coat and decides, as he contemplates his splendid reflection, that preferment and promotion must soon be the lot of such a brilliant and deserving young officer. If you'd been there, you would have seen his point, and the adoring maids. Captain Avery was everything that a hero of historical romance should be. He was all of Mr. Sabatini's supermen rolled into one, and he knew it. The sight of him was enough to make ordinary men feel that they were wearing odd socks, and women to go weak at the knees. Not that his dress was magnificent. It was sober, neat, and even plain. But as worn by Captain Avery, it put mere finery to shame. Nor did he carry himself with ostentation, but with that natural dignity, nay, austerity, coupled with discretion and modesty, which come of innate breeding. His finely chiseled features bespoke both the man of action and the philosopher, their youthful lines tempered by a maturity beyond his years. There was beneath his composed exterior a hint of steely power, etc., etc. You get the picture. For the record, this wonder boy was 6'2", with shoulders like a navvy and the waist of a ballerina. His legs were long and shapely, his hips narrow, and he moved like a classy welterweight coming out at the first bell. His face was straight off the BOP cover, with its broad, unclouded brow, long, fair hair framing his smooth-shaven cheeks. His nose was classic, his mouth firm, but not hard, his eyes clear, dark gray, and wide-set, his jaw strong and slightly cleft, and his teeth would have sent Kirk Douglas scuttling shamefaced to his dentist. His expression was at once noble, alert, and intelligent, deferential yet commanding. Sorry, we're off again. In short, Captain Avery was the young Errol Flynn, only more so, with a dash of power and Redford thrown in, the answer to a maiden's prayer, and, between ourselves, rather a pain in the neck. For besides being gorgeous, he had a starred first from Oxford, could do the 100 in evens, played the guitar to admiration, helped old women across the street, kept his fingernails clean, said his prayers, read Virgil and Aristophanes for fun, and generally made the admirable Crichton look like an illiterate slob. However, he is vital if you are to get the customers in. More of him anon. Secondly, and a sad come-down it is if you're a purist, meet Colonel Tom Blood, cashiered, bought out, and all too obviously our anti-hero. In his lodgings, a seedy attic in Blackfriars, with a leaky ceiling and the paper peeling off the walls in damp strips. He has fivepence in his pocket. His linen is foul, his boots are cracked, he hasn't shaved. There's nothing for breakfast but the stale heel of a loaf and pump water, and his railing harridan of a landlady has just shrieked abusively up the stairs to remind him that he is 6 weeks behind with the rent. But Colonel Blood is Irish, and an optimist, and lies on his unmade bed with his hands behind his head, whistling and planning how to elope with a rich sitz wife once he has brought the silly bag to the boil, and she has assembled her valuables. He'd need a razor from somewhere, to be sure, and a clean shirt, but these, like poverty, hunger, and a shocking reputation, were trifles to a resourceful lad who had once come within an ace of stealing the crown jewels. One should not be put off by the bad press given to Blood by that prejudiced old prude Mr. Evelyn, who once had dinner with him at Mr. Treasurer's, and kept a tight grip on his wallet during the meal, by the sound of it. "That impudent, bold fellow," he wrote of the gallant colonel, "had not only a daring but villainous, unmerciful look, a false countenance, but very well spoken and dangerously insinuating." Not quite fair to a dashing rascal who, if not classically handsome, was decidedly attractive in a Clark Gable-ish way, with his sleepy dark eyes, ready smile, and easy Irish charm. tall, strong, and well-made, perhaps not as slim as he would have liked, but trim and fast on his feet for all that, an affable, deceptively easy-going gentleman, and quite a favorite with the less discriminating ladies, who were beguiled by his trim moustache and lively conversation. A tricky, dangerous villain, though, when he had to be, which was deplorably often, for of all the colonel's many and curious talents, finding trouble was the first. So there they are, the two of them, miles and poles apart, and hardly a thing in common, except youth and vigor and blissful ignorance of the fate that was being determined for them 4,000 sea miles away. For now the scene shifts abruptly to grim Fort St. Bartholomew, lonely outpost of England in the far Caribbean, where at the water gate of the great rock-bound castle, bronzed and bare-backed seamen sweated in the humid tropic night as they carried massive iron-studded chests up from the boats at the sea steps and along the arched stone-flagged tunnel to the strong-room deep in the heart of that impregnable place. Guttering torches lit the scene as the sailors grunted and heaved and chewed quids of plug tobacco and spat and swore rich sea oaths as they labored, for every tarry-handed mother son of them had learned his trade in the Geoffrey Farnall school of historical dialect and could growl belike and looky and ha cheerly messmates all in that authentic Mummerset growl which would one day keep Robert Newton in gainful employment. So, with hearty heave-hoeing and avasting, they worked under the stern blue eye of their grizzled commander, and a weather-beaten salt of suitably bluff appearance, with a blue coat and brass-mounted telescope, who may well have been called Hawkins or Bransome, but not conceivably Vavasour Domfraville. "Arg!" cried the burly captain, twice for emphasis. "Arg! Easy handsomely, I say, with they chests rotty. 'Tis 10,000 pound you'm carryin', ye lubbers." This was his normal habit of speech, since anything else would have been incomprehensible to his crew. "A pesky parlous cargo it be, and all, and glad am I to be rid on it. Burn me for a backstay else." "Not as glad as my garrison will be to see it," replied the fort commandant, a stout and sunburned soldier who was equally perfect casting in his buff coat, large belly, and plumed hat. 3 years without pay is a long time in such lonely fortalice as this." He hesitated and ventured to add, "Damn me for a lizard else." "For a what?" inquired the captain, rolling an eye. Lizard," said the commandant defensively. "You know." "Arg!" said the captain thoughtfully. "A lizard, eh? Humph! Us seamen don't use to swear by no crawlin' landlubberly varmints, us don't. Handspikes and marlin spikes and such sailily things be good enough for we, by the powers, choke me wi' a rammer else. Howbeit," he went on, "I be mortal glad to see the last of these damned dollars. 1,000 leagues from old England be a long way with such a lading. Through pirate waters and all, d'ye see, rot me for a portingale pimp if it bain't." And he dashed the sweat from his brow with a horny hand. "Aye, split and sink me. A risky voyage, look ye. A passage right perilous, and happy I am 'tis done wi'. And they doubloon snug i' the cellar at last, scuttle me for a—" "How about some supper?" said the commandant quickly. "Victuals, says you?" cried the captain, rolling both eyes. "Why then, victuals it is," says I, "wi' all my heart, aye, and a flagon o' ale, devil a doubt, or Spanish vinos, ha ha, to wet our whistles, and damn all wi' a curse. Scupper me wi' a handspike," he said triumphantly, "else." The commandant, having conceded game set and match, they rolled off to supper, while the toiling seamen heaved and beliked and spat as they trundled the last of the precious chests into the strong-room, and the great door clanged to and was locked with a ponderous key. Thereafter they repaired to mess with the garrison, while in the commandant's chambers the officers supped off pepper pot and flying fish broiled, with many a tankard, and the sea captain amazed his hosts with the richness of his discourse. Sentries stood outside the strong room, but the long stone tunnel to the water gate lay deserted, and from the sea steps, outside the fitful light of the torches, shone on empty water to the little harbor entrance. Above, on the battlements, other sentries lolled, those dispensable sentries of fiction, who doze at their posts in their ill-fitting uniforms, mere cannon fodder to be knocked on the head or smothered by agile assailants, or at best wake up too late to fire a warning shot and yell, "Turn out the—" If the commandant had lined the walls of that lonely fortress with his entire force, instead of boozing and stuffing and throwing his wig aside in the carouse, all might have been well. But of course he didn't. They never do. So within Fort St. Bartholomew was all cheery complacency and unbuttoning, and without, the tropic moon shone on that familiar scene, the grim silhouette of the castle, the torch-lit peace of the Watergate, the wind sighing gently through the palm trees, the soft surf lapping the silver sand. All was tranquil, the moon's wake throwing its golden shaft across the rum-dark sea, the scent of bougainvillea and pimento on the breeze, and one might have imagined the soft strains of Spanish ladies on the lulling air, fading gradually away, to be replaced by another music, the almost imperceptible beat of something far out on the dark water, the chuckle of foam under a bow, the faint creak of cordage and timber, the soft whisper of a command, and the rising ghostly cadence of a wild sea march as a great dark shadow came gliding, gliding out of the night. For an instant the moonlight touched the pale loom of canvas furled, then it was gone, and the dozing sentries never heard the soft plunge of oars, or caught the phosphorescent glitter of ruffled water, or the grating of longboat bows on shingle, the splash of bare feet and sea boots in the surf, the glint of steel, the clatter of gear instantly hushed, or the shadowy passage of silent figures slipping through the palm groves. No, the sentries were dreaming of distant Devon, or half-caste wenches, or beer, or whatever sleepy sentries dream about. And by the time one of them glanced seaward, it was too late, as usual, because the menace was there, unseen, crouched in disciplined quiet beneath the very castle wall on the narrow path that skirted round to the open, inviting, torch-lit Watergate and its deserted steps, where only a few convenient boats rocked unguarded at their moorings. Wolfish, bearded faces in the shadows, earrings, headscarves, hairy drawers, dirty shirts open to the waist, bad breath, great buckled belts, cutlasses, knives, and pistols gripped in gnarled and sweaty hands, and at their head, all in snowy white, from breeches to headkerchief, big as a house side and nimble as a cat, Calico Jack Rackham, none other, cautiously edging his brutally handsome, square-chinned face round a corner of the Watergate, grinning at the sight of the torch-lit empty tunnel, turning to his followers, motioning them to be ready for the assault, whispering his final orders. First among equals was Calico Jack, by reason of being literate and smart and able to navigate and do all things shipshape and Bristol fashion, looky, as his admiring associates often agreed. Also, he was strong enough to break a penny between his fingers, which helps, and having served a turn in the Navy, he was reckoned dependable. In our day, he would have been a paratroop sergeant, or a shop steward, or a moderate Labour MP. He was a pirate because it offered a profitable field for his talents, and he was saving for his old age. First behind him came Firebeard, 6 feet, both ways, barrel-chested, with hands like earth-moving equipment, and so covered in the fuzz that gave him his nickname that he looked like a burst mattress with piggy eyes gleaming out of it. He was enormous and roaring and ranting and wild, and so thick he had forgotten his real name. He had been dropped on his head at an early age and never looked back. Nowadays he might have been an all-in wrestler, or a Hollywood stuntman, or an eccentric peer, or indeed all three. His idea of living was to hit people with anything handy, grab any valuables in sight, and blew the lot on wenches and drink. He was a pirate for these reasons, and also because he enjoyed bellowing those hearty songs which John Masefield would write in course of time. His eventual claim to fame would be as the model and inspiration of Edward Teach, who would copyright the habit in which Firebeard was at that very minute indulging, of tying lighted firecrackers in his beard to terrify the enemy. He always did this before action, fumbling and cursing as the matches burned his huge, clumsy fingers, while his comrades coughed and fanned the air. "He's at it again!" they muttered severally. "Gore, what a kick-up! Thou lubberly guts wilt set thy hair afire, foe! Turn it up, for God's sake! They reek offends, thou smouldering ape. 'Tis nauseous to rob thy company." This last contribution came from Bilbo, tall, lean, rakish Bilbo, pretending to elegance in his tawdry finery of embroidered coat, plumed castor, soiled lace ruffles, and fine cordovan boots with red lacquered heels. Actually, they pinched him excruciatingly, having been taken from the corpse of a small grandee whom Bilbo had skewered at Campeche. But Bilbo knew they were the height of fashion, and hobbled grimly in them through skirmishes and boarding parties innumerable. He was a sad case, Bilbo, really, although he looked anything but. A whapping guttersnipe, he yearned for gentility, having observed something of it as a barefoot stable lad in a great household, and later as a page boy, after his lithe young figure and raffish good looks had caught the jaded eye of his master's wife. His amorous energies had led to similar posts in the houses of susceptible ladies of fashion, and some of the heirs of the beau monde had stuck to him, along with the jewelry pilfered from the dressing tables of his exhausted paramours. Among sea scum he passed as a gentleman, having picked up a few tricks of speech from Congreve and Vanbrugh to supplement his gaudy wardrobe. He sneered and minced in sinister fashion, and made play with a rather grubby Mechlin kerchief, and wore a cut-price gem on his steenkirk. But don't underrate Bilbo. He might be a social pretender whose feet were killing him, but he had won his captaincy in the Coast Brotherhood by cunning, courage, and fighting ability. He wasn't called Bilbo for nothing. The long black rapier on his hip was reckoned the deadliest from St. Kitts to Coromandel, with staccata and imbroccata and punta inversa, saha! And he had a nice showy trick of spinning up finger rings and impaling them on his flourished blade, like the Duke of Monmouth. Not easy. Nowadays Bilbo would have been a lion tamer or an advertising executive. He hoped to make enough from piracy to buy an estate and title. For the moment he sneered at Firebeard's efforts to get his crackers going, and took a pinch of snuff from the box preferred by Goliath, his faithful dwarf. "A barbarous affectation," he lisped, "thou vulgar big Burke!" "At least I don't have a bloody goblin in tow," growled Firebeard, and Goliath, who was all of 2 feet tall and had a wooden leg, hopped and gibbered in rage. Suddenly the firecrackers took light, and Firebeard chortled while the air turned blue. "All ready," whispered Calico Jack, and a fierce chorus of "Aye, aye, Cap'n, we ready for sartin," answered him, with the odd "Blike" and "Looky" as an afterthought from the more eager spirits. And as they crouched for the assault, up from the rear came the fourth leader of that desperate enterprise, cat-footed and stately, and those hairy ruffians fell back, eyeing her askance with lustful respect as she stalked by, hips swaying, with a trace of Pierre Cardin lingering on the sultry air as she passed. 6 gorgeous feet she was, from the heels of her tight-fitting Italian thigh boots, from Gucci, undoubtedly, to the curling plume of her picture hat, breeched and shirted in crimson silk, that clung to her like a skin, lithe and sleek and dangerous as a panther. Sheba, the black pirate queen, looking like something out of Marvel Comics, with her lovely, vicious face and voluptuous shape, her dark eyes flashing against her ebony skin, smoldering silently as she unsheathed her dainty rapier with its Cartier hilt and posed with the contemptuous grace of a burlesque star, indifferent to the ecstatic sighs and groans of her besotted followers. She had that sort of effect on men. It was notorious that when, in boarding a galleon, her shirt had been ripped off by an enemy pike, her entire crew had had to go on bromide for a fortnight. She never walked. She prowled, exuding menace and sex appeal at every step. But none was so hardy as to presume on her femininity, for Sheba was as cruel and deadly as she was beautiful, and her scorn for men was proverbial. True, in the forecastle, they breathed rumors of sizzling orgies in her secret fortress on Octopus Rock, with prisoners who were afterwards done diabolically to death. But that's forecastle gossip all over. Born a Barbados slave, she had clawed her way to power in the coast fraternity by a piratical genius and ruthless ferocity that had made her the toast of women's liberationists all along the main. Her fellow sea wolves respected her, had astonishing fantasies about her, and went in terror of her, and she despised them all with a curl of her shapely lip and a lift of her perfect Egyptian nose and a low-lidded glare from her smoky, slanting eyes, fingering her one long silver earring the while. Only to Rackham did she show the respect due an equal, and the big man treated her as a brother. 3 centuries later, Sheba would have been on the cover of Vogue, or leading a soul group. She was a pirate because she hated the world for enslaving her, and took a sadistic pleasure in killing. Men, for choice, but women, given half a chance, and quite small animals. All round they were a happy little gang of eccentric cutthroats who crouched in the shadows under Fort St. Bartholomew's massy walls that balmy tropic night, waiting for the word from Rackham. And then they were storming up the passage, yelling bloody murder, while sleeping sentries above fired futile warning shots and ran about with their muskets at the high port. By then the pirates were slicing up the guards at the strongroom, forcing the door, bursting open the first chest and a cascade of gold coin, into which Firebeard, exploding all over the place, threw himself, brawling, "It's the dollars, a bloody fortune, ha-ha, Calico, Sheba, Bilbo, we'm rich!" He always shouted this on taking a prize, whatever its value, while his firecrackers set his hair ablaze and those nearest choked and spluttered. A tiny Welsh pirate crouched by the open chest, eagerly counting the coins, 1, 2, 3, until someone yanked him aside. Up in the commandant's room, they were exclaiming and belching and grabbing up their wigs and overturning chairs and shouting useful things like, "Pirates!" and "The pay chests!" and "Sound the alarm!" and "Goose me with a handspike, we'm beset!" And by the time they tumbled downstairs, all hell was breaking loose. The pirates were bearing out the treasure chests under Rackham's directions, while Bilbo, firing his pistols with an elegant air and tossing them to his dwarf for reloading, was commanding the covering party who were at grips with the belated redcoats. It was desperate work, what with shots banging in the enclosed space, and powder smoke everywhere, and pirates cursing as they were wounded, and redcoats falling down obligingly when they were shot, and Bilbo fleering and shooting, and Black Sheba leaping like a leopard, skewering with deadly daintiness, and Firebeard bashing and bawling. The commandant rallied his men with cries of, "Blister me!" and blundered bravely ahead, crossing swords with Sheba over a couple of fallen bodies. He thrust clumsily at her chest and paused, shaken, as he realized that his target, instead of being a conventional masculine torso, was more like something painted by an enthusiastic Rubens and bouncing most distractingly to boot. "Sink me, it's a woman," he concluded loudly. "Strike me speechless," he added, which was prophetic, for "with pleasure," hissed Sheba, and glided in like a dancer, perfect teeth bared in an unholy smile, and the commandant tripped and fell flat on his back. A high heel pinned him as she flicked aside his hat with her rapier point, whispering, "Doff, dog, doff to a lady." And the last thing the commandant knew was that black face mocking down at him and a tearing pain in his throat. The soldiers fell back, appalled, and as the last of the chests was borne down the passage, Rackham roared his followers back and away. They retreated, firing down the great stone tunnel, while Sheba, the bloodlust on her, slashed and stabbed and laughed, with Firebeard beside her, swinging his cutlass, roaring, "Take that, you lousy lobster! Kill 'em, tear 'em, kill the honest men!" And Bilbo carefully shot an officer in the shoulder and turned to supervise the stowage of the chests in the waiting longboats. Shepherding his men, Rackham looked back along the shambles of the tunnel to see Sheba alone fronting the disheartened soldiery, flourishing the rapier and screaming, "Come on, you king's men! Fight! Is one woman too many for you, you mangy cowards? Fight! That's what they pay you your shilling a day for!" "And it's not enough, either," was the universal thought among the military as they faced that black and crimson fighting fury. But the wounded officer tugged at a lever in the wall, and above Sheba's head, through a slit in the stone, a great portcullis gate came swishing down. "Too late!" Rackham cried a warning. "Too late!" she saw and sprang back. The great steel frame fell to divide the corridor from wall to wall, and although Sheba snaked beneath it to the seaward side, it pinned her ankle cruelly to the floor, and she lay, trapped and helpless, her face contorted in agony, her rapier clanging on the flags. The pirates, with appropriate oaths, ran back to help. Firebeard strained his mighty thews in a vain effort to raise the portcullis, roaring, "Heave, you maggots!" and getting back the usual excuses like, "'Tain't no manner of use we heaving, Cap'n. Look ye, she'm caught-like, and us can't shift the bugger nohow.' Meanwhile, the soldiers, encouraged by the fact that there was now a stout steel gate between them and the pirates, surged forward, shooting. One even rushed up and tried to bayonet the fallen Sheba through the bars. But Bilbo snapped an order. The dwarf Goliath sprang to the bars like a monkey. Through them went his wooden leg, and out of it shot a steel blade to drink the soldier's heart's blood. Full of tricks those pirates were. But Sheba, writhing on the flags, was fast as ever, and as the others banged away overhead, Rackham knelt beside her. "It's no use, comrade. We can't shift it. Do you want to go quick, girl?" For garrison reinforcements were crowding down the tunnel, and Rackham looked to the priming of his pistol. "Leave me," gasped Sheba. "Each takes his chance. Law of the Brotherhood." Firebeard, of course, was having none of that. He was a proper pirate, after all. "We'll fight it out by the powers," he bellowed. "I don't leave no messmate in the lurch, by cock. Burn, damn, and blast me if I do." And he beat his fists on his chest. "Balls," cried Bilbo, forgetting his affectations in the heat of the moment. "She's right. If we linger, we are undone. Anyway, we've got the loot. Shove off." No nonsense about Bilbo. He strode to the sea steps, and the longboat surged into the night, heavy with the booty. Several pirates dragged Firebeard into the last boat, heedless of his bawling, "We can't leave her. Let's cut off her leg." And for a brief moment, with the last pirates on the steps, keeping the soldiers at a distance with their pistol fire, Rackham was left alone by the pinned and helpless woman. "Go, Calico, quickly," she gasped. And the big man stared down at her with tears in his eyes and stooped to kiss her brow. "I'll be back for you, camarado. wherever they take you, we'll get you out." And then he was gone, springing down the steps to the last boat, and it shoved off into the darkness with the pirates singing, "15 men on the dead man's chest," which is not actually a very good song to row to. Consequently, they caught crabs all over the place and wallowed in a welter of gold coins and bilge water and rum, with the boats bucketing about. The redcoats on the battlements should have picked them off easily, but, as everyone knows, in such circumstances redcoats never hit anything, but pop off their blanks in a most desultory fashion. But while the pirates eventually regained their ship, the soldiers in the tunnel were bearing down triumphantly on the slim crimson figure pinned beneath the portcullis. Sheba cast one agonized glance after her departing comrades, choked on tears of pain, gnashed out a truly disgusting oath at her enemies, and then lapsed gracefully into a swoon. The wounded officer, clutching his shoulder, ordered the portcullis raised, and kicked the insensible figure cruelly in its shapely ribs, snarling, "We've got this heathen slut at any rate. Gad, but we'll make her pay for this!" Which is a suitably dramatic moment to bring this first chapter to a close, with the powder smoke a-reek in our nostrils, our principles introduced, and delectable dusky villainy in the clutches of the law. What will the brutal, beastly soldiery do to Black Sheba? Will they? What if Rackham's promised to save her? Does Bilbo even care? And what has all this got to do with the handsome Captain Avery and the rascally Colonel Blood? We shall e'en see in chapter the second.